Novus, the new voice. Vox Novus, the new dimension. Vox Novus, thought and movement leaders who will share from their experience and offer tools to help us navigate our rapidly changing world. My name is Victor Furman. Welcome to Vox Novus, the new voice. In the past few months, I've been including public service announcements that emphasize STEM education for young women. STEM is an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and math. In our rapidly changing world, there's a growing need for new entrants into these fields, and young women in particular. How may we encourage young women to seek out STEM-based education and careers? Who are the women who have followed that path and are making enormous contributions today? What special insights and approaches have women brought to these fields, and how are they benefiting our country, our world, and all of humanity? My guest this week on Vox Novus, Zahra Stone, has examined those very questions. Zahra Stone is an award-winning journalist who writes for The Atlantic, The Washington Post, 10, Wired Magazine, Cosmopolitan, The San Francisco Chronicle, The BBC, and Forbes Magazine, among others. She was born in London, England, and moved to New York for further study. She graduated from Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism and jumped into the U.S. media world, reporting for The Wall Street Journal, then transitioning to on-air reporting for ABC News. Now a full-time freelance writer and author, she's spends her spare time playing games in virtual reality, speed reading 120 books a year, hula hooping, and falling off her paddleboard. She lives in San Francisco and cares for 3 artificial houseplants. Her website is zahrastone.net, and she joins me this week to discuss her just-published book, The Future of Science is Female, The Brilliant Minds Shaping the 21st Century. Please join me in welcoming to Vox Novus, Zahra Stone. Welcome, Zahra.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. When we welcome guests for the first time, we ask them to share their paths and how they evolved. Please share with our listeners your story and how it led to your career.
Absolutely. And with such a great introduction, I feel like you already know part of it. But I think, it's kind of the traditional story about journalism, kind of the cliche. Like from when I was younger, I just always really liked to write, and I was very curious about anything. And you're growing up in the age kind of where there was no Google, and when you ask your parents a question, they don't always know the answer. It means that you have to kind of go out and figure things out for yourself. And we live in kind of such a mad, interesting world that I just constantly was asking stories. I was the kid in class, you know, putting my hand up again to ask the teacher why and how, almost till it annoyed them. And that's kind of been the trajectory of my career. So I've just, you know, from kind of university where I did English, which people, you know, is like, what do you do with an English degree? And they're like, you teach or you write. And so I kind of took the writing route. And I wrote a lot about news and technology and have always just been fascinated by the tech space because you don't really get kind of newer or more interesting than that. And like so much of the technology we have today is pretty much the work of science fiction. You know, like we live in an age where it kind of sounds like you're reading a Heinlein novel. And so I just kind of worked in the world of tech reporting, and a lot of my work was kind of on the news space, so reporting for BBC and other publications about, you know, the new phone, the new camera, the, you know, crazy world we call the internet, and kind of everything in between. And after a period of time, I think I got a little bored with just kind of doing news stories. I really wanted to kind of do more people stories. Because, you know, technology, like the product is one thing, but then how people use it, that's really the interesting part. And they intersect so nicely together. And there's not a super amount of room to do that in kind of hard news reporting. And I wanted to do more feature stories and more kind of on-air work. So I went to Columbia University School of Journalism in New York, and that really kind of trained me in all the good methods of kind of doing these kind of longer narratives and kind of working with people and looking at their lives and going into this. And that really just essentially kind of developed my career in America. And from there, I worked for ABC News, and I kind of jumped from there into freelance writing for Forbes and Wired magazine and many others, and ended up in San Francisco, which, you know, was kind of like the dream place for a tech journalist. You know, like you can walk around the city and the cars, you know, don't have any drivers, and like little robots roam the sidewalks delivering people lunch. And you just have all of this in like a really small environment. So it's kind of like the Mecca. And it's just been a really kind of fun but interesting journey.
I'm a child of the 50s, the 1950s, and growing up in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s without having all of this wonderful technology, we did things the old-fashioned way. I've embraced technology, I've worked in technology, worked with technology, but do you see a downside to technology?
I think the idea is, you know, people want to switch off, and like we all know the dangers of social media and how much of your life is lived online. And I think it's important to disconnect, as in, you know, don't look at your phone so much you fall over on the sidewalk. And there's, you know, a danger in rushing technology, like, you know, let's not, you know, rush a vaccine because, you know, our tech says it might work, but, you know, we haven't proven it out. But essentially, like, we live in a technological age. I think, you know, it's always important to be wary. But I don't think we can ever, you know, forget about it or just try and, like, wind it back anymore.
As a woman journalist and someone who chose the field of tech, have you experienced different treatment than your male counterparts?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for one, none of my male counterparts ever got sent laptops that were pink or, you know, phones that were pink. They tended to get the black ones, and I would get the pink phone or the purple phone, and that's just in the kind of tech reviewing space. I mean, in general, you know, it's been a lot of kind of microaggressions, less about, you know, people being necessarily super dismissive and more about you're in a crowd of reporters and you're asking questions and, you know, they pick the guys first. Or, you know, you're talking and then somebody just talks over you. I think a couple that stand out particularly is kind of going to, I think this might have been the launch of the first iPhone. And kind of some of the journalists that I didn't know very well, some of the journalists who'd like flown in from other countries essentially thought I was a public relations person because I was a woman. And, you know, it's a mostly male crowd, but even so, just, you know, I was in jeans, like the public relations people were in like black dresses. It was just kind of that mentality.
And have there ever been assignments that were given to a less qualified male correspondent or journalist than you?
It's really hard to say about that. I think there's always, you know, that feeling when you're like, oh, I would have liked to have done that story, or why didn't I get that? But I don't think you can ever, at least for me personally, ever be like, oh, they gave it to that person because he's a guy. In my experience, at least in the newsrooms I've been in, it's really just been based on who the editor thought was best for each story.
As I mentioned in our introduction, I first learned of STEM for young women when the Ad Council sent a group of public service announcements a few months back. How did you become aware of the STEM initiative?
I guess I'm going to answer your question with a question. Like, when you say you first learned of STEM, I mean, you know what science is, you know what technology is, you know engineering and math. Was it more that you kind of became aware of the acronym, or like how did it come across to you?
I became aware of the acronym and the fact that there was an initiative for young women.
Gotcha. Okay. So, yeah, like I think basically, like, you know, the parts of the initiative aren't new in terms of like everyone understands, you know, what STEM stands for. Even though, you know, putting it together is something we're not always as familiar with. And I think, to be honest, the acronym dates back to around maybe 2005 or something. And it kind of started as this big initiative with education. And the idea being that there were kind of two things mainly. Like, for one, you know, the jobs in STEM fields are growing, and it looks like there was going to be a really big shortage like when you have people forecasting what's needed in 10 years, 20 years, and they just start seeing this really big gap, especially in America. And America tends to kind of pride itself in being the latest in technology and innovation. So that was a concern. And then the other concern is, because it's so based on education, not everybody has the same access. So over time, you know, people like low-income people, people from underprivileged backgrounds, or, you know, who don't necessarily have computers at home, stuff like that, were falling more and more behind and kind of creating this unequal paradigm that we see today in many ways. And so by kind of pushing the STEM initiative and kind of making it a really strong curriculum in schools, it just integrated more people and kind of really got them up to speed. And there's also, people don't know this as much, alongside STEM, there's the STEAM initiative. And here the A stands for arts. And it's kind of the idea of how a lot of the STEM fields intersect with art. For instance, you know, you get artists who like will create amazing things by programming an AI to like draw something, and all the different ways they interconnect. So really embracing the creativity alongside the STEM.
What inspired you to write The Future of Science is Female?
Sure, now that's a good question. And I think the idea really is, in my work, I go out and I interview a lot of entrepreneurs, and I kind of speak to startups, and I speak to kind of software engineers and all of these people. And living in Silicon Valley, it's, you know, famously male, famously white. And these are things I'm aware of, you know, they're trying to work on that. But whenever I kind of look around or, you know, read news articles, and like we do have female founders and female startups, but as a generalization, a lot of the female startups, like the big names that people will recognize, they tend to kind of be in the beauty or fashion space. And, you know, kudos to them, like, you know, Rent the Runway, all those guys, they do a really great job of what they do. But with Silicon Valley's emphasis so much on kind of the science and the tech, it didn't really feel like women were very well represented. And there are many, many women doing super cool things in science and tech, but you just weren't really hearing about them because, you know, they were maybe too early stage, or like what they were working on wasn't particularly sexy. And like, that's not to say you didn't hear of anyone. I mean, you know, Sheryl Sandberg and the Lean In initiative, which, you know, basically inspired a generation. But even the women who were working in tech and were super well known, you know, they tended to be kind of older, like, you know, late 40s, 50s. They were mostly white. And so just kind of thinking about it as a little girl who's kind of interested in the space, like they seemed really inaccessible, right? Like, I think when we're growing up, right, our parents always give us advice. And like as a kid, well, I guess I should say for me as a kid, I was kind of like, whatever, that was your generation, right? Like, it's not relevant to me today. And so I think to all the kids who are, you know, looking for role models and want to be get into this space, like they're impressed by Sheryl Sandberg and other people like her, but it kind of feels a little bit too distant, like just not super relevant to like the space they are now. So I really wanted a book that would kind of represent people like women on their journeys who are in the kind of, you know, mainly like early 20s, early 30s, to just feel a bit more like a kind of almost like a big sister role model, somebody like the girls could read about and just think, oh, that's super cool. Like, she did it. She's only like 10 years older than me. I could do it. And that was kind of the goal and like the reason I like spoke to the different people I did and like how I was thinking about the book from the beginning.
And what is your target audience for this book?
So it's kind of middle grade to kind of early young adult. So depending on like the comprehension and reading skills of the kids, kind of anywhere from around, I'd say like 9 to 13 years old.
Okay. And of course their parents.
Yeah, I suppose a lot of the parents will be buying it for them and maybe, you know, reading it as well.
We would hope so. What are the career paths that STEM offers young women?
So in terms of career paths, essentially the same career paths as boys. And it's very, very versatile. Like it goes from computer engineer, you know, or software engineer working on, for instance, the iPhone, to a video game developer, to a robot designer, a autonomous car designer, a fragrance scientist, a Hollywood special effects artist, an astronaut. It's just kind of an endless list, which is what makes it so exciting, because I don't think you necessarily assume all these different careers fall under the STEM banner.
You had touched upon this a little bit earlier. There are diversity issues in STEMs, as there are in other forms of education and career paths. What are the percentages?
So the percentages are pretty bad. I have a list here. So it all starts right at the educational level, and kind of, you know, that's the point where people get the skills or they don't get the skills. And in general, like, about half as many girls as boys are interested in STEM by eighth grade. And that drops to 15% by the end of high school. And then when we kind of look in further education, kind of fewer than 4% of Latinas and 3% of Black women get doctoral degrees in science and engineering. Women make up 20% of all undergraduate degrees in engineering, physics, and computer science, but only 11% end up working in STEM. And, you know, there are systemic reasons for why this happens. And partly it's kind of a self-sustaining problem. For instance, take the jobs at Facebook. Like in 2014, 15% of all tech jobs were made by women. For women of color, it was, in 2018, 0.8% of like Black women were hired by Google in terms of the amount of new hires. And so you have people kind of being like, oh, I don't know if I want to go into engineering, kind of it's all men. So that's an issue. And also is the issue that there's not really a support system. And like, you know, it feeds on each other. And like, you know, as you get more white people in tech, like white people don't necessarily consider like Black problems, like many different things and cultural things that aren't as considered because they don't have a representation.
How may these issues be addressed?
I wish I had the answer to that. I think, you know, it takes kind of many, many people at many, many levels to kind of help change what, like the dynamic we have now. It takes kind of better education in school, more support in after-school activities, more coaching, more counseling, better control of students, more encouragement at work. It's a many kind of layered system. And I guess where I'm hoping that my book fits into this picture is that when people read it, at an early age, which is, I think, one of the most important places to start, because this is an age where, you know, girls will either stay interested in the topic or they'll kind of move on to something else. And so kind of reading this and learning about these really cool women and the different things they've done and, you know, that they were like able to date and still like create a super cool startup will be encouraging and kind of make them be able to see themselves that way.
Would you advocate that there be special teachers and special teacher training to go to elementary, junior high, and high schools and bring this to these young women?
I mean, I think it'd be good. I mean, and I think this probably exists in a way that, you know, they are encouraging younger people interested into STEM and into STEM fields. I think the idea is as early as possible to kind of get across that STEM isn't a career that's only for boys, and then it's super cool, and then it applies to girls too. And the more we move away from, you know, girls like pink, boys like blue, the closer we'll get.
And what about programs like scholarship offerings for young women to encourage them to go forward with these fields, especially in the minority communities?
I think that's fantastic. I think purely just giving scholarships isn't enough in a way. So it's, you know, or you pay for tuition, but like maybe you're not paying for housing. So it really needs to be kind of thought out better and have all these different attributes taken into consideration.
My guest is Zahra Stone. She's the author of the new book, The Future of Science is Female. Zahra, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and your work.
Sure. So you can get my book on Amazon, Bookshop, and pretty much any online bookshop right now. And you can read more about me and the work on my website, which is zarastone.net.
And we'll be back with more of Zara after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio. IOM FM. OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Learn more at She Can STEM, a message brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
Hi, it's Olivia Munn with my shelter pets, Frankie and Chance, reminding you that when you adopt a shelter pet, you discover all the things that make them unique. Adopt pure love at theshelterpetproject.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council, the Humane Society of the United States, and Maddie's Fund.
A social distancing tip.
While the CDC urges you to avoid close contact, like hugging or shaking hands, there are other non-physical ways to say hello. Wave, wink, use sign language, salute, smile, give the peace sign, throw up an air high five, do jazz hands. Remember, stay a minimum of 6 feet or 2 arms length away from others and stay home if you can. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
1 in 3 adults has prediabetes. 1 in 3. That means it could be you, your football buddy. Your football buddy. Or you, your best man. Your worst man. You, your dog walker. Your cat jogger. While 1 in 3 adults has prediabetes, with early diagnosis, prediabetes can be reversed. Take the risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org. That's doihaveprediabetes.org.
Wait, did they just say 1 in 3 adults has prediabetes? That's 33.33333% of adults. That means it could be me, my boss, or my boss's boss, or me, my favorite sister, or my other sister. That's 7 members of my 21-person romantic book club. Wait, the 1 in 3 could be me, my karaoke partner Carol, or my karaoke enemy Jeff. I'm going to take the risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its pre-diabetes awareness partners.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week is Zara Stone. She's the author of The Future of Science is Female, The Brilliant Minds Shaping the 21st Century. Zara, please share with us some of the wonderful endeavors and accomplishments of women in STEM. Let's start with an area of concern around the world, the food supply and world hunger.
Sure. And, you know, this is a really big problem. And I think right now with what's going on, people aren't really focusing on it as much, which is understandable. But it doesn't mean that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people aren't starving. And so I think I'll tell you the story about this really wonderful girl called Kimberly Lee. And her thing is she kind of, she's a daughter of an immigrant, and she kind of grew up, her mother was from Vietnam and she grew up in Canada and everywhere. And she's always been one of these girls who's just, you know, probably you'd think she was obnoxious growing up because she's just super smart, really interested in everything, graduated from school when she was 16. And she's just always been someone who's very aware of the world in nature and she used to like to go diving and skiing every year. And she would go to the mountains one year, and then she came back the following year, and I think she was around 17, and she just saw how there was less snow, how there was less foliage, and it really shocked her, I think. Like, we all know the effects of global warming and climate change, but we're not necessarily seeing them every day. Like, you know, it's more of a gradual thing. And so for her, being able to see it that starkly, because you're in a more extreme environment, really shook her. And the more she looked into this, she started kind of realizing the bigger problems we all have. And being that there are so many areas to tackle, food was where she decided to start. Her mom had cooked her, you know, dinner every night and had ended up having a career as a chef. So she was really attuned to kind of a food world and understanding scarcity. And, you know, growing up, it was like always finish everything on your plate. Like when I was young, we didn't have this much food. And so it became an issue that Kimberly was really passionate about. And while she was at university, at school, she was offered this course called the Plant Collider course, which was all about exploring the idea of kind of new foods and new way to make foods. And as she was kind of investigating, she decided that meat is a really unsustainable resource. Like, it creates a huge amount of like methane, which is really bad through the atmosphere. And it also, you know, uses up a lot of water and takes up all these other resources which could be better used to feed people. So what she did is kind of working with a couple of people in the lab, and she's about, I think, 20, 21 at this point, she comes up with a fungi-based meat. So essentially she created, you know, a fungi-based beef, fungi-based chicken, and all of these different things. And like, you know, you had to taste the test. You had to kind of get other people to believe in you. She had to raise funding. But the idea is that as she scales this up, it's a really sustainable food. It, you know, takes very kind of little water, the few ingredients, and you're really able to translate this and kind of get it to like low income populations, get it at areas of the world where they have like an enormous food scarcity, and just really be able to kind of change people's diets. Like, it's really healthy as well. And just like the development process of it kind of came from something she was passionate about.
And you had also shared with your readers a story about her with reference to shrimp.
Yes. So the shrimp story, because there's a lot of amazing girls who work in this space. And that was by another, a different girl called Dominique Barnes, because there are so many talented 20-somethings that it's almost incredible. And Dominique Barnes, she grew up actually in Las Vegas, which isn't, you know, somewhere you necessarily think about nature. And while she was there, she would go to the Vegas aquariums and she would look at the fish, because she just really loved the ocean and everything about it. And then as she grew older, she started to realize how unsustainable seafood is. Like, you know, to make, I think, like a pound of shrimp, so like an enormous amount of mangroves are destroyed. And like, you know, this takes away from like the jungle ecosystem, and it disrupts like the plant life and the natural order of things. So her goal was to create a plant-based shrimp, like one that looked like a shrimp, tastes like a shrimp. And she did it, essentially. Like, it was a progress. You know, her first few versions weren't particularly tasty and looked a little bit gnarly. But then she ended up creating a really tasty shrimp in a line of foods. It's called she's now CEO of New Wave Foods. And you can get them in Whole Foods and some other places in California.
And how old is she?
So she was around 22 when she started this. I think she might be 27 or 28 now.
Wonderful. That's such a wonderful story. You touched briefly about Kimberly's concern about our environment and climate change. These obviously are areas of critical concern. The fires out in California right now, and temperatures that are soaring in parts of the world, and glaciers melting. Who are the women scientists addressing this?
So this is a really fun, interesting space for development, especially because it's so pertinent and necessary because of what's going on. And so one women scientist I interviewed and who I'm always very blown away by is Itosha Cave. She lives in San Francisco, but she grew up in Texas, actually. And, you know, Texas surrounded by kind of oil wells is not necessarily where you think people will get really into the environment. But actually, Itosha, she saw kind of the chaos the oil wells and the drilling and the other things was creating on her home. And it made her really want to do something. And so what she came up with essentially is a CO2 conversion machine. And so it gets technical here, but essentially it's a little machine she can pop on top of factories. So rather than them emitting all their gases into the air and, you know, getting across the earth, she can capture it at the source. But the conversion element of the machine means that she'll like take in all these gases, but then what she outputs, she can turn it into green fuel. She can convert it into like green plastics. So, you know, it's like the perfect circular economy. She's taking in the waste that factories just throw into the air, and she's essentially making money out of air, but also helping the environment at the same time.
Dramatically reducing the carbon footprint.
For sure. And right now, like, you know, this isn't a theory. Like, she has a she has a couple of machines. They work. They've been tested on factories. Like, it hasn't got to scale yet. So, you know, we've only got it on a couple of places. But as her company grows, you know, just imagine if every single factory had this, like, pollution from factories would instantly be gone. And I think Bill Gates is an investor in her. And, like, people are really behind what she's doing.
And a dramatic reduction of the greenhouse effect, which will stabilize the environment.
Oh, and I remember speaking to her because, you know, it's twofold, right? We don't want to keep adding to it, the greenhouse gases. But then we also have so many greenhouse gases, it would be good to do something with it. And speaking to her, she said, and, you know, this is still very early days, that her next project, she'd like to be able to essentially send this machine up into space. And so it can kind of walk, you know, go around and just kind of gobble up the gases.
Wonderful. That's really, is she working with Elon Musk?
No, but she probably knows him.
Okay. With all of the news reports about research into developing medicines and vaccines for COVID-19, some of the most rational information being presented is coming from women. Who are some of the women at the forefront of medicine right now?
So, God, it's hard to pick people. There are just so many doing really interesting things. I think one woman I'm very impressed with, her name is Vivian Chu. And she is kind of taking the approach more from a practical side. So she has kind of visited many, many hospitals, and she has a background in robotics. And while she was kind of going through the hospitals, she noticed how, you know, shorthanded the nursing staff are. And we've seen this today, you know, like nursing staff are getting sick. Like, there's a problem with manpower. You know, people need to care more for the medical team. And she was also noticing how inefficient a lot of nursing was. So, you know, one nurse would like pick up a bunch of things from like room number one and have to run all the way down to like the room at the other end of the building to pick something up from there and then return to room number one. And nurses have one of the highest burnout rates out of like most many professions. And so this seemed like a really serious pain point. And she decided that she could fix this. So with her background in robotics, she decided she wanted to build a nursing robot. And so, you know, she created her first robot. I think it's about 7 feet tall, and it looked like a big bowling pin, kind of orange and white. And kind of nurses took one look at it and were like, we don't want this anywhere near us. And she was like, okay, well, you know, that was many months of work, but I'll go back to the drawing board. And then her next robot, the focus, you know, was one, it had to be efficient and make the nurse's life easier, but it actually also had to be cute. And cute is, you know, not normally a priority for hospitals in terms of equipment, but in the idea of getting people acclimated to robots and getting used to them being part of their everyday life. it became really relevant here. So the new robot, called Moxie, was much shorter and also much cuter. So we're talking about kind of rounded edges. And, you know, on the head, like, has little LED lights for eyes. And if you say Moxie's name, the eyes will turn into little LED hearts. But it's also extremely efficient. So, you know, she's equipped with a bunch of AI and sensors. So she sees somebody coming, she can get out the way. She's been programmed with all this kind of nonverbal communication. So somebody talks to her and she'll like tilt her head and do all these tiny little interactions that humans do back when we're chatting to each other, the kind of thing we miss so much right now. And she just really cut down on the nurse's workload. You know, and the end result of this is it's easier to do their jobs, there's less burnout, and it's safer because, you know, they don't have to spend as much time kind of doing the things or dealing with the waste or different ways they could get infected.
And what are some of the other chores that Moxie performs?
So she can deliver blood from like one place to the other place. She's HIPAA qualified, so she can like look up patients' records and correct charts and make sure the right kind of things are dispensed. She can deliver sheets. She can, you know, go up and down different floors. She's also, the kids really like seeing her. Not so much a, you know, a task, but an added benefit.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. Speaking of robotics, technology, artificial intelligence is in the news almost every day. Who are the female leaders in these areas and what are they doing?
Sure. That's a good question. And one of the women in the book that I spoke to, her name is Clementine Jacoby. She's the CEO of Recidiviz. And Recidiviz is a criminal justice startup. And the idea behind this and the way she uses AI is particularly interesting because Clementine is really worried about the incarcerated population. And we know in America, you know, there's a lot of people who are in prison these days. Like, you know, we imprison more people than like any other country. And like our numbers are like horribly high. And she looked at this and she's like, there's something wrong here. You know, people like nonviolent offenders are serving silly amounts of time in jail and murderers are getting out quickly. And there's no real way to track like what they're doing and how life is treating them. For instance, you know, there's a difference between somebody who goes out on parole and, you know, he does an offense and he's rearrested. And in the criminal justice space, the offense could be not paying a fine of $40. Or it could be, you know, burglary. But in the ways of like the criminal justice system, it doesn't really take that into account in terms of the arrest. It's a parole violation, like end of chapter. And the reason for this is because the criminal justice system is ridiculously antiquated. And there really was no system kind of linking the differences in the arrests to the person. And so she, using an AI program and kind of getting into all this really old, you know, gnarly data from all the different agencies, she's put together programs that really help officers track offenders, kind of work out how they're doing, predict success rates, and also just enable check-ins. And that might not sound like the kind of AI you think of, you know, when like Big Brother watching you and all that kind of stuff. But it's the kind of complex equations and being able to adapt as you get more information that make what she's doing so valuable.
That's wonderful. My guest is Zahra Stone. She's the author of The Future of Science is Female, The Brilliant Minds Shaping the 21st Century. We'll be back with more of Zahra after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
It's time for today's STEM tip. Okay, you know recycling is important. No one wants plastic in the ocean. Here's a cool way to repurpose a plastic bottle. Build an awesome terrarium. Cut a large plastic bottle in half and fill the base with sand, pebbles, potting soil, and your favorite plant. I chose an African violet. Put the top of the bottle over your base and place it in the sun. Your plant will grow sealed in its own ecosystem. Fun, right? Learn more at She Can STEM. A message from the Ad Council.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up, like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Hi, this is David Strickle. I'm excited to share my brand new show, The Stream of David Live, right here on Om Times Radio. Each week, I'll have exciting guests, and I'll channel the eternal wisdom of the stream, a group of non-physical entities whose teachings have transformed lives all over the world. So join us for an uplifting hour each Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern. That's The Stream of David Live, right here on Om Times Radio.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager, Learning the Lingo.
Today, I'm going to help parents translate teen slang. Now, when a teen says something is on fleek, it's exactly like saying, that's rad. It simply means that something is awesome or cool. Another one is totes. It's exactly like saying, totally, just shorter. As in, I totes love going to the mall with Becca. Another word you might hear is jelly. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will think you're, rad, just the same. To learn more, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Social distancing slows the spread of coronavirus, so stay a minimum of 6 feet away from others and stay home if you can. More info at coronavirus.gov. Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week is Zahra Stone. She's the author of The Future of Science is Female, The Brilliant Minds Shaping the 21st Century. I'm having a fun day today. Zahra, there are many non-STEM postgraduate careers with opportunities for young women. What are some of those exciting fields?
Now, that's a fun question. I think I have to say journalism.
Okay.
Which might overlap a little bit because you go into STEM topics. And then, you know, there's a wide variety of professions, lawyers. Gosh, I was going to say doctors, and I was like, no, that's a STEM profession. But yeah, so, you know, lawyers, journalists, writers, psychologists, therapists. And I guess there's a little bit of overlap there, but I think kind of STEM feeds into so many careers that it's hard to get completely away from it.
In your research, what are the ones that have high demand right now?
So it's really interesting in terms of high demand. So you might not know this, but there's like a really big demand for mechanics right now, or at least pre-pandemic. And the idea being that as autonomous vehicles, as an industry grows, You won't really need, you know, a lot of kind of car people on one side, but somebody has to maintain all these autonomous cars. So it's looking for mechanics with kind of different skills. And there's actually a bunch of different universities have training programs specifically for autonomous vehicle mechanics because there's such a predicted shortage.
And I can address a couple of industries that if young women are listening tonight or their parents are listening tonight, they may consider. I spent 42 years in the welding industry, and there's a critical shortage of skilled welding people. And a lot of young women are being asked to join the welding industry, and also electricians and plumbers and all of the mechanical contract type of work. There is a dramatic need because so many people have gotten into technology that they're the people who fix things for us and keep our houses in order and do the welding and the building and so on are in high demand. So those are career opportunities that are there right now. And if anyone's interested in welding, check out the American Welding Society, aws.org, and there's a lot of information about careers in welding there. So thank you for allowing me to interject that and share that.
I know, that sounds fascinating.
Do you have a personal favorite or two stories that you would like to share about women who've succeeded in STEM or something else?
Sure. So I love this story. It's about this girl called Erin Smith. And so in 2015, she was a kind of just a 15-year-old girl who lived in Kansas. You know, high school kid, you know, likes sports, likes boys, all that usual stuff. And she also liked TV. She was watching a TV show featuring Michael J. Fox. And she was just kind of looking at him. And Michael J. Fox, if people don't know, kind of sort of was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 1998. And like we know about this, and this has, he's been kind of public about that. But like as she was watching him on TV, something about his interview just kind of nagged at her. Like the way he smiled and the way he laughed, it just didn't really connect with her. Like it seemed very emotionally distant, I think is what she told people at the time. And so she didn't know, like, is this a side effect or something that happens with Parkinson's? And she called up a bunch of Parkinson's specialists, you know, really interesting girl, Erin. And they told her that, yeah, like, this is kind of one of the side effects that can happen. And, you know, this kind of, like, lack of emotion, like, they said that this is something that actually shows up in Parkinson's patients, like, years before they're diagnosed. And, you know, early diagnosis is a really big deal for Parkinson's because the earlier kind of you get the diagnosis, like you can start taking medication and you can stave off a lot of these symptoms. And so when they told her that it like happens earlier and that, you know, you'll actually be able to find these like micro expressions, it got her thinking. Like it was like, why can't we detect it earlier? Like, is it just that people aren't trained or, you know, you just think someone's not that emotional? Like, she just didn't really understand it. And so she was really into science at school and she was in all the clubs. And so she had this really interesting idea, very millennial as well. So in her mom's kitchen, you know, using like stuff from the cupboards and all of that, she built a selfie camera. But it wasn't just a selfie camera. It was a really smart one. And the idea is you can take pictures and it kind of captures these tiny, like micro changes in facial expression over time. And she called it FacePrint. And what made it so smart is that she wrote an algorithm that, you know, analyzed features, compared it to other ones, and using a bunch of different sections on the face, was able to predict with 88% accuracy rate whether, you know, somebody had Parkinson's years before they actually had it. And there, and what she created is super, super impressive because there are other things like this that exist, but they're at a very like high price point level, and they're the kind of things that will be used once you already have a diagnosis. So, you know, you kind of want to know before you have it. That's the whole point. And the really expensive machines, they have something like an 81% accuracy rate. So her cheap home kind of kitchen made thing had this 88% accuracy rate and, you know, was made of really low cost materials. And I'm just blown away that a 15-year-old could think about this. She could like think, oh, selfies, like something everybody knows. This is a really clever way to integrate it. And yeah, so I just really get excited about her story, I suppose.
That's a wonderful story. Do you have another one?
So there's I can think of another cool girl, actually. Her name is Priwalia. She's an Indian girl. And her interesting thing was that she kept seeing, you know, all of these young girls lose interest in STEM. Like, for whatever reason, like, more and more, like, they just weren't into it. And it really upset her because she's always been interested in tech. And kind of growing up, it wasn't necessarily encouraged for her. And what she decided is, you know, maybe instead of like being like, you know, toys for everyone, unisex, everything, maybe she needed to lean in to the girly thing a little bit. Because she's a girly girl. She's, you know, she loves having her hair done and her nails done. And so what she created was a nail art printer that you could do at home. So, you know, a little printer, and you like pick a design and you put your finger under the printer, and it prints a pretty little nail varnish on your nail with a sticker that's, you know, a smiley face or a Facebook logo or whatever. But where this gets interesting is she didn't just create the NailBot, which is the name of the printer. She created the NailBot kit. So the idea being that this ships to girls, and they have to, like, the first thing they have to do is build the thing. Like, and it's not, you know, like a Lego assembly. Like, you have to solder, you have to figure out the instructions. And like, so the first thing is the assembly. And secondly, it works through an app, which is where you like program the app to put all the different designs that you like. And it's an ongoing process because you're creating artwork and you're coding it and you're sending it to the nail art printer. So it really combined many different levels of things at the same time.
That's absolutely brilliant. What a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing that. Of course, all of this is designed to inspire and encourage young women. What would you say to their male counterparts?
I would say that, you know, just be cool, and but be actively cool. You know, it's not enough to be like, yeah, girls can do this, girls should do that. And I hope that's the default, at least for like young boys these days. But that's not enough to kind of be, you know, a passive supporter. You know, like when a girl speaks up in class or tries to answer a question and, you know, the teacher ignores her or like points to somebody else, or, you know, the girl says an answer, but the teacher like only listens to somebody else's answer. You have to speak up. You can be like, no, Angela said it first, or this wasn't my idea. This was Katie's idea. And you need to be an active supporter.
Advocacy, very, very important. What are the steps needed to encourage girls to STEM?
So I think the steps needed are, you know, one, kind of being, like you say, advocacy, being an active supporter of girls' options. Kind of two, like, you know, offering the different pathways, because, you know, not every girl wants to code a nail art printer. Maybe a girl will want to, like, go to drone camp. Maybe she'll want to build a robot. Maybe she just wants to, like, program an algorithm to throw water on her mother. I don't know. Just realizing that STEM isn't one thing, and kind of being open to exploring all the many facets of it.
And what message do you have for parents of young women when it comes to STEM?
I think it would be the idea of to make it fun and to try not to push it too much, because I know we all have, you know, parents who want, or many of us have parents who want the best for us and, you know, really help us succeed. But I think parents can get, you know, a little competitive, like, oh, I want my kid in Harvard or Yale, or, you know, if you go into STEM, you'll earn more money. And while that's probably true, you know, the idea should be that it comes naturally, because not every kid will want to be into STEM. You know, maybe it will be STEAM, maybe it will be welding. And the idea is to give them space and be able to explore it themselves and, you know, buy them the tools or the toys, if you can afford it, or, you know, find other ways to access that so they can enjoy it.
What would you like your readers to take away from The Future of Science is Female?
I guess I think the main takeaway is, you know, that girls are awesome. Boys are awesome. Science and tech and engineering is awesome. And so much amazing stuff exists that we don't, you know, not everybody knows about. And just kind of learning, you know, from kind of CO2 converters to saving the oceans, like these aren't pipe dreams. Like people are working on this. And if the kid has a dream or something they want to do, like they can do it. Like maybe it won't work, but the second time you'll learn, and then the next thing you do will work, and how it's a process.
Absolutely. My guest is Zahra Stone. She's the author of The Future of Science is Female, The Brilliant Minds Shaping the 21st Century. Zahra, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and this amazing work.
Sure. So you can get it on Amazon and on Bookshop and on, you know, any online book retailer. And you can learn more about it and about me on my website, which is zahrastone.net.
And that's spelled ZaraStone.net. Zahra, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining us on Vox Novus. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week. Thank you.